Welcome to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640 Los Angeles. We are live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. If you've been listening to my show for a while, you know that I have a PhD in clinical psychology, and I'm absolutely obsessed with the science of human mating. Yes, love has a science to it. There are biological pieces, hormones, etc. There are psychological pieces, our early life attachment style, and there are social pieces. Who fits in on paper with your social world, right? And today I want to kind of pull anybody off the guilt train who's on the guilt train for being single. You know, I have been single for a lot of years. And when I say I've been single for a lot of years, it doesn't mean that I haven't dated or I haven't had a few partners along the way. But really, my primary attachment has been to my two daughters. As a single mother, I've been raising them for 15 years. And I feel that, you know, I need to give them the most expensive thing I have, which is my time. And that would be unfair to be able to get into another relationship. And I wasn't interested in doing the whole blended family thing. So anyway, I've been single for a long time. And I didn't notice that I was being discriminated against. Just little times I would feel lonely and wonder why. But now I realize, according to research, that singleism, like sexism or racism, is a thing. It's discriminating against people who are single. And to extend that even further, it's two researchers at, I think they're at UC Santa Barbara. They've also coined another term, matrimania. This idea that you're nobody unless you get married. Matrimania. Oh, Lord. All right. Let me explain where we actually are in the world right now. In 1960, 72% of adults, that means everybody in America over the age of 18, were married. Now we have 51% of adults in America who are married, which means the single population is almost half and half. Here's how single people are discriminated against. And I'll tell you, actually, the first time it ever happened to me, and I didn't even realize it because I was young and I was busy colluding with patriarchy. I didn't even know. Is I went to my boss at a news station and I told him, like, I thought it was like something like just a little mistake, like a clerical error, that a male colleague of mine was making more money than I was for doing the same job. And when I asked about it, he said, well, you know, he's married and has a family to support and kids. So that's why we did it that way. And you know what I said? Oh, I understand. Because I was colluding with patriarchy. What I didn't see on the horizon was my future as a single mother for 15 years, where I would have liked to stockpile a bit of money from that job I had in my 20s. Thank you very much. I didn't know that I would be the primary breadwinner in my family eventually, and I needed to financially prepare for that. So that was the first time singleism ever happened. Now, there are also lighter things that happen to single people. I'm not being a whining victim, by the way. I'm just telling you, this is what's going on. Is married people love to hang out with married people. And the first time I learned that, I was also a young woman. I had a killer reservation at some hot restaurant, and I had a date who was going with me, and I was inviting this married couple friends of ours. So I had a table for four on the right night at the right restaurant. And then my date had to work. Something happened and he fell off. So I called my friend who was part of the married couple and I said, so-and-so can't come, but don't worry, my friend Maria is going to join us. Actually, I left it on her voicemail because I remember she called me back and she said, my husband is not going to go out for dinner with three women. Like, ooh, dining with three women is an awful thing. Like, what do? Just talk about makeup and shoes all night? I don't know. Is that going to offend a dude? And so I was like, oh, I've been told. And, but now I see on Facebook, thank you, Facebook, fear of missing out, that my couple friends get together without me. That I'm missing certain invitations because the couples do like to socialize with each other. So that's what I would call social discrimination. But there's other kinds of discrimination that single people experience. By the way, the reason why most of the laws and public policy in this country favor married people is because the government didn't want children out of wedlock on the public coffers. So they wanted to encourage people to get married, and they wanted to encourage them to stay married. So married people get tax breaks. They're much more likely to get approved for a mortgage. Even though single women are the most common home buyers in America, often the mortgage bankers think, oh, well, she's going to default. She doesn't have enough income. Did you know that marital status discrimination is legal according to the Fair Housing Act? Married people pay less for health insurance and car insurance. You know, you can add your spouse on for a nominal fee to your health insurance or your car insurance. But if I wanted to take a good friend of mine and extend my health insurance to them, I could not, right? Or a cohabiting partner probably couldn't. But get this. You know what single people do more than married people? Because they have more time. They volunteer more. They're more likely to know their neighbors. They have way more disposable income. And it is the single sibling who ends up doing the bulk of elder care of parents and also disabled family members, right? The black sheep brother ends up at the home of the unmarried sister. That's how it goes. And so these single people, though, don't get to take maternity leave to take care of the elderly. I think more progressive companies are being more fair and creating family leave for any kind of family. But I think there is this old idea in us that being married is the only way to be. Now, for raising children, I will say that purely for statistical reasons, having two people who both have a biological interest in the offspring in the nest still will create more successful outcomes for offspring. That doesn't mean single parents can't do a great job. It doesn't mean that the parents have to have a biological interest. There are amazing step parents out there. But in general, that's where the statistics are the best. Also, this huge single population still is very optimistic that at some point in life they may want to get married. But why do we have matrimania? That somehow you're less of a person if you're not married. So I want to say this. If you are a single person, I want you to be joyfully single. I also want you to cultivate a couple friends. And if you're a couple and you have single friends, you need to invite them not only to your holiday table, but to any kind of event. They're not less of a person because they're single. They're half the population. They're half the sky. No, that's girls, right? Half the sky. So I'm just saying, we need to open up our idea because the demography is showing that families are changing. The way people live is changing. Women are becoming more free to marry later or not marry at all and still be joyful, happy, and purposeful, be involved in their communities and to care for their families. So there, I'm starting off with a whole little lecture on relationships. And on the same line, in the next few segments, I would love to bring you a special segment of my podcast, Mating Matters. The episode is called Mothers, MILFs, and Wives, and it looks at women's reproductive choices. I know last week in part one, we talked about alloparents, people who don't have a biological connection to kids, but who give to them, very important in our evolution, child-free women, and also women who've made the choice to become mothers. There are lots of ways to reproduce, and Mothers, MILFs, and Wives looks at the evolution of women's reproductive choices. We'll be back on the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show with Mothers, MILFs, and Wives after this.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me.
You know, motherhood has got to be the hardest job I've ever had in my life, and it paid the least. Hi, it's Dr. Wendy Walsh. You're listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. Motherhood. Isn't it a joy? I mean, I don't regret it one little bit because it created so much meaning in my life. I will say that I did not have any maternal urges at all until about the age of 32, and then it was a scramble to try to find either good genes or someone who would hang around for a little bit. But once I really got into it, the only thing I wished was that I had started earlier. because it was so joyful. No, it was also stressful because kids are expensive and kids need the most expensive thing you have in the world, which is your time. And it really does take a village. So there's some psychology into building that motherhood village. Let's take a listen to the next part of Mothers, MILFs, and Wives Part 2. This is part of my podcast that you can find anywhere, wherever you listen to your podcasts. The podcast is called Mating Matters. Ever wonder why we evolved to have child-free men and women? They were important to our evolution, too. This is Part 2 of Mothers, MILFs, and Wives, a look at women's reproductive choices. Listen to Part 1 if you haven't already. In this episode, women get real about reproduction. There's probably no deeper, heart-wrenching, emotional experience for women than the feelings that surround reproduction. Hope for a baby, the loss of a baby, the joy of a baby, the worry over a baby, and the feelings of sadness when a woman's fertility window closes with no baby in sight.
Say I love you. That was a good one.
Welcome to Mating Matters, the podcast that looks at human behavior through a lens of evolutionary psychology and human mating strategy. I'm Dr. Wendy Walsh. Humans are wired to bond, and we're wired to reproduce. But the risks and burden of reproduction seem to fall unfairly on women, who face the sometimes terrifying challenges of survival with children in tow and have to make heartbreaking decisions about which babies get to survive. This isn't new. Our cavewomen ancestors also faced harsh environments. A famine a millennium ago became a recession and job loss today. They were presented with mates who may or may not have offered paternal care, like today's faithful, fastidious fathers, or deadbeat dads. And cave women faced the sometimes spotty availability of family and friends as helpers. Same problem today. Yesterday's village of women has been replaced by the baby yoga group and the preschool parent association. But know this, whether you are a man or a woman, you're here on the planet today because your hunter-gatherer ancestors, whose DNA runs through your blood, were experts in human mating and reproduction. Let's talk about how mothers get it done. No doubt about it, talk of female reproductive choice can bring all kinds of fierce emotions to the surface. Nothing is more visceral for humans than the desire to create and protect life. Mother Nature wired us that way. This is our human survival instinct at full throttle. That's why we may judge others' choices, because we evolved to be cooperative breeders. On some deep cellular level, when a woman makes a reproductive choice that we wouldn't make, say, having too many children that she can't afford, or terminating a pregnancy, our shared instinct is to protect. In this podcast, I'm going to ask you to work hard to keep the urge to judge in check. Let's be social scientists together and grow a greater understanding of the pressures and choices all women face. Human beings are problem solvers. We are constantly adapting to a changing environment. Many modern women reproduce a lot like our hunter-gatherer ancestors. That is, they have two or three surviving children while avoiding death during childbirth. By the way, one big evolutionary trade-off was narrow hips for bipedal motion. Walking upright on 2 feet required very narrow hips. When we were down on all fours, hips were wider, pregnancies longer, and deliveries were much safer. Tall, thin apes like us have a heck of a time pushing out big-headed babies.
Take a deep breath. I got your baby. Push.
Come on.
Another good deep breath and press.
I got him. Stop.
But our environment has always been changing, and we are slowly changing in response. Lately, advents in medicine and technology are new tools created to help women win the mating game. Before that, here's how the reproductive lifespan looked for millions of years. First of all, In our hunter-gatherer past, girls matured much later. The age of puberty has been going down for the last century. We'll have to do a whole episode of Mating Matters on the factors involved in precocious puberty. Did you know that 10% of girls get their first period at the age of 8? For now, just know that in our ancient past, girls got their first period in their late teens. It took about a year for their periods to become regular, and then they were pregnant for like a year. Back then, since there were no blenders or Gerber baby food, babies were nursed, breastfed, until they got their two-year-old molars or even years longer. Mothers' bodies were the main source of protein until kids could chomp on an animal leg. And round-the-clock nursing suppresses ovulation and naturally spaces babies years apart. It's natural birth control. By the way, don't count on it if you night wean or supplement with bottles. I don't want to get an email from you. Thus, human babies were naturally spaced about 3 to 5 years apart. There was also a high infant mortality rate. And some kids, let's face it, got eaten by predators. So once a woman hit the end of her fertility window in her 40s, she likely had about 3 children who actually survived into adulthood. And she spent most of her adult life either pregnant or breastfeeding.
Every 2 minutes, one woman is diagnosed with breast cancer somewhere in the United States. And in every 5 women diagnosed, about 1 will have HER2-positive breast cancer, a more aggressive form of the disease known for putting its patients at a higher risk of recurrence.
Side note, one of the reasons that modern women have such high rates of breast cancer is the assault of estrogen on their breasts every 28 days with menstruation. Our hunter-gatherers probably didn't have 300 periods like modern women do.
If you get periods, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Every month, you shove a little piece of cotton into your vagina, and that comes with a lot of...
So delayed motherhood, using modern contraception that keeps women having those periods, is a new technological invention that helps women space babies, but now increases the incidence of hormone-related cancers. According to the American Institute for Cancer Research, women who breastfeed for extended years have lower rates of breast cancer. The advent of farming was another technological age that women had to navigate. Before that, hunter-gatherer women may have had years of serial monogamy, say 5 to 7 years, where they depended on a great man to help with food and protection while the kids were young. But with the advent of farming, all women were expected to do this with one man for a lifetime. They were also expected to have many, many children because they needed labor for the farm. Now that we're past farming and the Industrial Revolution and into the information age, long-term monogamy has hung around. That's because it's still a successful reproductive choice for many women.
My husband and I got married in March, and I was pregnant in April.
I've known my husband for 25 years. We have been together for 19, and we've been married for 9.
I have 4 children and 1 grandchild, and I've been married for almost 25 years.
And thanks to another technology unavailable to our hunter-gatherers, sperm donation and artificial insemination, even same-sex couples can have long-term monogamy along with reproduction. This woman has been with her now wife for 28 years. They have 2 sons in their 20s. Did one of you bear them? Did you adopt them? Do you mind me asking?
We each had one.
Oh, I love that.
We each had one, yeah. And we went through a sperm bank because, you know, we didn't want to go to a friend that might knock on the door 10 years later and say, hey, can I take Johnny out for a little while? Because, you know, I helped.
The payoffs to motherhood are enormous.
I think it made me a much kinder person. I'd like to think I was a nice person before. But when you think about the fact that you are molding the future, you know, and molding the next generation, it really made me much more empathetic to, you know, everybody around me.
Humans are a fascinating primate because we can love a child that is not biologically ours. Until recently, it was thought that we were the only great ape. Oh, pop quiz, folks. Name the 5 great apes. Chimpanzees, I knew you'd get that one right away. Gorillas, good. Orangutans. Bonobos. And
yo,
us, Homo sapien. Okay, back to the lecture. Until recently, it was thought that we were the only ape that adopted other apes' kids. But Christoph Bosch of the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Germany found 18 cases where chimpanzees in West Africa adopted orphan chimps. and that adoptive parent was sometimes female and sometimes male. I love men. We're going to take a break now from my Mating Matters podcast. The episode is called Mothers, MILFs, and Wives. And when we come back, we will bring you more of women's interesting reproductive choices. I'm Dr. Wendy Walsh. You're listening to The Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640, live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. You know you love your kid when they take a full-on tantrum on an airplane and you want to throw them out the window or open that emergency door and toss them, but you don't. I should say, by the way, this is Dr. Wendy Walsh. You're listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. I had two high-need babies, one more than the other. I think one screamed for like 6 years, and I was kicked out of movie theaters. I was kicked out of stores. I was kicked out of restaurants and, yes, off an airplane once because she just loved a tantrum and scream. Eventually, we ended up at UCLA's friendship program where I learned a tantrum extinction plan, which was pretty fabulous. I'll have to teach you sometime. Let's go back to my podcast, Mating Matters. The episode is Mothers, MILFs, and Wives. Because humans have cooperative breeding, adoption has been a long practiced custom for couples who had problems conceiving. Most humans have compassion for babies without parents.
Well, I think if you're in a financial position to do it and can devote the time, there's so many kids in the world that don't have guidance, and it's really, really sad.
Well, I always thought that if I ever actually did want to have a family one day, that I would really like to have one and then adopt one. I always thought that that would be the most amazing, perfect, beautiful way to do it.
Our daughter is our biological child, and I couldn't get pregnant after her again. And so we had, sadly, five adoptions fall through. But on the fifth one, we got our wonderful son. So I was there at his birth, and he's just like part of our family from the instant he got into our family.
There is perhaps no better theater to watch female reproductive choice play out than in the adoption arena. It's highly emotional. Adoptive mothers wait and hope for a chance to nurture, while birth mothers make life and death survival decisions for themselves and their unborn babies. Emotions run high.
My husband and I went to the county initially, and it was a room full of about maybe 30 couples. And one of the first questions they asked was, how many of you have children already? And my husband and I were the only ones that raised our hands. And everyone looked at us like, how dare you come in here when you already have a child and we don't have a child? So my husband and I stepped back a bit and said, gee, you know, I don't want to take that away from someone.
Over several years, though, this woman and her husband searched for a child through private adoption 5 times.
One of them was in the service, and her father was handling it, and he found out we weren't Jewish, and that was a problem for him. So we couldn't get that. We had a young girl who was 12 years old, and she was having a baby, and I went to the doctor's office, and they said, please, this young girl wants to give you the baby because she can't take care of it. And we found out that the mother was approached by an infertile couple, and they said, we will put you up at the Beverly Hills Hotel. We will buy you a car if you give us your child. So then we had a couple of other problems where the mother decided to terminate the pregnancy. Another one, she decided to have it. And then the last one where my husband, he's a psychiatrist, and he said, let's not get involved in this last one. Let's wait until we, you know, have the baby coming home to us. The baby was born. We named it. We had the doctor check it out. And then the next day we got a call from the mother's sister saying she wanted to keep the baby.
Ironically, this mother was a childbirth educator. She worked with pregnant women, and yet she had to wait 13 long years for her adoptive son to arrive. In the end, her new baby came to them through a personal contact. A coworker of this woman's hairdresser suddenly became pregnant.
She didn't, I guess, have enough money for birth control, and she had conceived before. And I taught her childbirth classes for her first child. And so then 3 years later, I went to the hairdresser. I don't go that often. And I saw that she was pregnant. And I said, oh, is she expecting another child? And they said, yes. And then my hairdresser said, are you still interested in adoption? And I said, yes, but I don't think adoption's interested in me. We've had quite a lot of trauma. And so she said, just a minute. She went and talked with her. And the woman came back over and said, I can't think of anybody I'd rather have my child than you.
In the end, although one of her children was biological and one came to her through adoption, she says she loves them both the same.
A lot of people say, don't you love your biological child more? And absolutely not. Absolutely not. And so sometimes my daughter says, really? You don't love me more? And I said, no. I said, it's just, I never think of him as being adopted. He's just part of our family.
Besides adoption, modern Homo sapien women have two other technological tools to help them survive: in vitro fertilization and egg freezing. Young women are now coveted in the workforce as we've entered the information age. Yes, we are better talkers, better typers, and we have more social sensitivity. As a result, reproductive survival today may involve using vital years of fertility to build a nest egg. The solution? Extend the fertility window by freezing eggs.
It may look like a party, but this is an information session for one of a growing number of egg freezing boutiques.
For me, it's really just for being proactive about it.
Run by entrepreneurs, this new crop of egg freezing studios costs a fraction of traditional IVF clinics.
But there's something that hasn't changed at all: the necessity for alloparents. Alloparents are extra adults, non-biologically related to children, who help raise them. 1 in 5 American women do not reproduce, either by choice or circumstance, and this is natural for our species. Think about it. Mothers and fathers don't parent alone in a vacuum. In fact, we're not meant to do it alone. Here's anthropologist and primatologist Dr. Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy of UC Davis. Her book, Mothers and Others, makes a clear case that all the extra parents are a big reason our intelligence exploded so that we took over the world. I mean, there are way more ants than us, but they're not in charge. And lions are top of the food chain, but they don't run the show. We are the brains on top, partly because of alloparents. Here's some of Dr. Hurdy's UCLA talk called Born Human, How the Utterly Dependent Survive. You can find it on YouTube.
The human infant confronts all the same challenges that other apes do, but both the mother and her infant are going to have to factor in this extra support from pre-reproductive helpers, from male helpers, whether it's the father or whether it's this band of bros out there showing off, grandmothers. They have to factor in these extra concerns. They are not able to count on the 4 to 8 years of single-minded maternal dedication that an infant chimpanzee or orangutan might. These infants were in competition with the mother's older children when they're born, and those of you who have siblings know what that feels like. They're also in competition with their mother's alternative reproductive possibilities, a baby that might be born at a better time. The mother's mate has just left, but she might get a new man and the next baby born then. And this leads to a very special challenge of humans and only a very few other primates, of mothers discriminating between offspring, possibly retrenching, and as has happened, I'm afraid, all too frequently in human history and prehistory, bailing out altogether.
When she says bailing out altogether, she means it. There's a very dark side to female reproductive strategy that's horrible to imagine. Complete abandonment of a baby, or even infanticide. Infanticide has been practiced by mothers since the beginning of time. When a mother weighs the pressures of survival with a baby against the pressure to feed herself and keep existing siblings alive, she's always had to make a gut-wrenching decision, a kind of Sophie's Choice. Which child will survive? Sophie's Choice, starring Meryl Streep, is a heartbreaking film set in World War II. A Nazi officer forces Streep's character to decide which of her 2 young children will be killed. All animals do it. Some eat their young. With dogs, mothers often reject the runt of the litter. In humans, there are even some cultural customs that give new mothers the privacy to make that excruciating choice. In the Republic of Guinea-Bissau in West Africa, New mothers stay secluded inside their mud hut for 10 days after their baby is born. Mothers do not name their babies until they emerge. This is partly because infant mortality rates are so high in that country. And, anthropologists speculate, it also gives a desperate mother an opportunity to suffocate her infant. Other examples of maternal seclusion abound. A Chaga mother of Uganda remains indoors with few visitors with her infant for 3 months after birth. When she and her baby finally emerge for the first time to make a public appearance, they do a kind of ceremonial walk, and they're greeted with the same song sung to warriors returning from battle. She and her baby have survived the weeks of danger. Again, this is also an opportunity for infanticide, for mothers to literally make life and death decisions in private. And lest you think this practice happens only far away from home, an FBI supplementary homicide report shows that 500 children are murdered every year by a parent. And a study by the Department of Health and Human Services reported that each year in the United States, more than 22,000 mothers abandon their babies in hospitals. And who knows how many are simply dumped elsewhere.
I think if it was Saturday morning.
26-year-old mother of two, Joanne Hauser, runs out to grab milk for that morning's breakfast.
And I thought I heard something like a cat.
A closer look revealed a paper bag next to a dumpster.
I looked into this bag and there was a baby in the bag.
A baby, astonishingly naked with the umbilical cord still attached.
I picked up the bag.
We'll go to a break now. You're listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640 and my podcast, Mating Matters. The episode's called Mothers, MILFs, and Wives. We'll have more when we come back.
Oh, help me, please, doctor. I'm damaged.
You're listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. We're live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. And now the conclusion of my Mating Matters podcast episode, Mothers, MILFs, and Wives, a look at women's reproductive choices. The reproductive problem of infanticide or abandoned babies actually has been reduced by technology in the form of abortion. Now, I warned you at the beginning of this podcast that feelings may bubble up for you around this subject. And I know they're painful, visceral feelings. Whatever your feelings about abortion, I want you to know that a version of it has always existed in our species as women made life or death decisions about survival. Every year in the United States, more than 2 million women terminate pregnancies. One in four U.S. women will terminate a pregnancy in her lifetime. Because we're cooperative breeders, on some unconscious level, many people believe that all babies belong to the village, not just the mother. Thus, there's a stigma around abortion, and even pro-choice women hesitate to tell their story. Today, there's a movement to have women come out publicly about their abortions to help remove some of the stigma. I didn't feel like I should subject any of the women I spoke to with the pressure to tell their story, although many of the women we spoke with had terminated pregnancies. Instead, I decided to be brave. And separately, with producer Brooke Peterson figuratively holding my hand by holding my gaze, I recorded this story. I was about 30, and my mom had suffered from breast cancer on and off for like 5 years. She'd been in and out of therapy, and we kept thinking she'd do okay and not okay. But I had this boyfriend who, you know, was probably not going to amount to much. He was a lovely boyfriend and a good friend at that time. And I was a news anchor, so I was getting a lot of cystic acne. And I went to the doctor and they said, well, we have this lovely drug called Accutane. And I got to say, each individual pill in its own capsule, you push out of the little, you know, bumpy plastic thing. And it had like a Ghostbusters thing with a big headed, crazy looking baby on it. Like, no pregnancy. This will create a deformed baby. And wouldn't you know it, while I was on Accutane, while my mother was dying of breast cancer, while I had a relationship that was probably not going to be a future relationship, I became pregnant. Now, you can analyze all day long how that accident happened. But when I went to my gynecologist, she was just like, you're never going to get a doctor to bring this baby to term. First of all, the baby's going to grow very deformed. We don't know how much pain the baby's going to feel inside you during the pregnancy. And secondly, once it's born, it's going to die. Hours, days, weeks. And the worst part for me is I wanted to just done with right away. She said, now listen to me carefully. You will find a doctor who will terminate this pregnancy earlier, but I need you to grow this baby for 10 more days. And it was hard because for 10 days I was so nauseous. I get such terrible morning sickness. And then I got the call from my mom. And all she said is, I'm not well. Those were the last words I heard my mother say to me. I'm not well. And my brother got on the phone and said, you better come home. Now, they knew nothing about this. And I got on a plane, and 30 minutes after I got to my mother, holding her hand, she died. And it was the saddest day of my life. You know, crying all night because I was feeling nauseous. There was this thing growing, and, you know, I could hurt it by growing it more. And losing my mother. And yeah, the day after her funeral, I flew home and I terminated the pregnancy. But it was a decision that I was forced to make medically, but might have made anyway. Because at the end of the day, I knew how hard motherhood would be. Today, I have two daughters, one about to turn 21 and getting ready to graduate from college, and the other about to turn 16 and get her driver's license. With both my parents having passed away long before I had children, and a male co-parent who wasn't really into parenting, I've been a single mother for 15 years. I could not have done it without the help of so many allo parents. All human parents are surrounded by cooperative breeders, teachers, coaches, neighbors, clergy, doctors, other parents, teenage babysitters, step-parents, daycare workers, and of course, companies that pay parents so they can feed their children. There's a big village around most children, but that doesn't negate the feelings that sometimes come up for allo parents, even for those who have made a clear intellectual decision not to reproduce. They still often live with some kind of cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is the act of uncomfortably holding two opposing feelings at the same time, the urge to reproduce and the desire not to have children. And it can feel very painful. This woman is in her mid-40s.
You know, I've been so borderline on the subject forever, my entire life, really. And even though I think I will be sad when I'm older, I think back and I don't know what I would have done differently. I don't feel like I made any mistakes or missteps. I've always valued my freedom so much, and I was never really ready to settle down. I thought of kids as claustrophobic, or like they'd suffocate me, you know? and I guess I needed a guy to come along to tempt me to change that thought. But he never came. So, but then, you know, on the other side, my dad died last year, and I didn't have kids. My brother didn't have kids. So there's no future, really, for our family. And that really stings, you know, and it just sucks that the family line ends on our watch. You know, we're the final generation, and that doesn't feel good, you know? And I wish it could have been different somehow, but it wasn't. And this is just the way it is.
I'm sure you've heard the saying, it takes a village. Mothers make sacrifices and grapple with feelings of envy for child-free women. Child-free women sometimes wish they were mothers. But as cooperative breeders, we're all in this together.
One thing I think it has taught me is that we're not all that different from each other. When I can be in a room with women who seem like they have totally different experiences and walks of life, their careers could not be more different from what I do. And yet we pull out pictures and talk about our kids. And it's like we're all just human beings on this journey. And the things that we let divide us are really insignificant.
I have to admit, this wasn't an easy podcast to produce. And it's probably been just as hard for some of you to listen to. The scientific realities of human mating and reproduction aren't always rosy. And I have so much compassion for what all women and men go through. Though I'll add that revealing the entire game board gives me a kind of peace. I don't know. I see the environmental pressures on humans, whether those pressures be the difficulty in finding mates, experiencing unrequited love, heartbreaking stories of children lost or children that never came to be. For some reason, it helps me to understand people better. And as a mother of two healthy daughters, I spend a whole lot of time feeling grateful for them and my alloparents' village. I may have won the mating lottery, but I really feel my alloparents have won it too. Now, when are we going to start celebrating Alloparents Day? Thanks for listening to Mating Matters. I'm Dr. Wendy Walsh. Up next, the price of manhood. How pushing men into a man box can hurt them. Mating Matters is produced in partnership with iHeartMedia. It is researched, interviewed, and written by me, Dr. Wendy Walsh, and it is edited and produced by Brooke Peterson. You know, people don't learn about podcasts usually by just searching around. They learn about a podcast because somebody who loved that podcast told them about it. So I encourage you to please subscribe, write a review, and more than anything, hit that share button now. Think of somebody who would like to hear this information as much as you enjoyed it. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram at Dr. Wendy Walsh. Listen to Mating Matters on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Wendy Walsh. I'll tell you, we all just need to stop judging each other, right? Thanks for listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show and being with me here on KFI AM 640, where we are live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. You can also find my podcast, Mating Matters, wherever you listen to your podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and of course, the iHeartRadio app. I'm Dr. Wendy Walsh. Thanks for being with me on the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show. We'll see you next time.